so few of us here this evening, and 50% are in the background. We're a friendly group. If you feel like standing up and coming up forward, I'm sitting down so I can't lurch at you. thank you, Janie. Okay, this is the third of a six-part presentation. There are handouts for it. If you'd like a handout, just raise your hand. I'm sure Will will get it for you. That's one way of getting him off the back seat. Okay, everybody's covered then? Great. Glad to have you with us. I'll try to make it passably short. Yeah. We're looking at the case for creation. Like I said, this is number three. We're going to take a little break between this one and the next one, because next week is when we usually have the filling in of last Sunday of the month preacher, and that'll be Dan. So you should be looking forward to that. I know what he's got planned, so he'll do a good job. As for what we're getting into this evening, we're looking, like I said, the case for creation. Last week we looked at the causality, law of causality, cause and effect. And we're starting off with to show that these things are covered in the scriptures. We're looking at the law of biogenesis, which basically says that cell reproduces after its kind, which is what God started off by saying, Genesis 1:21, and God created every living creature that moves after its kind, and every winged bird after its kind. So the Bible promotes the idea of biogenesis. And what we're doing here is kind of pitting scientists against scientists. We kind of got me started on this. Was I was running into some quotations from young people that would say, well, I don't believe in God because I'm a scientist. You know, there are things that just kind of set you off. First of all, I don't know if they were legally scientists or not. But it, just because you think you're a scientist doesn't automatically shut down a belief in God. In fact, let me get into the introduction here. Where the teaching of evolution is concerned, the one-sided indoctrination of students by this materialistic philosophy in the tax-supported public schools of our democratic society, that's a long sentence, is a violation of academic religious freedoms. It is poor science and poor education. You know, for a while now, they've proposed having the two models, the scientific model, or the creation model, and the evolutionary model, saying, well, just look at them and see which is best supported by the evidence. And they kind of shot that down. So in such cases, the creationists have an impressive arsenal of evidence to confirm the conclusion that the creation model better fits the available scientific facts than the evolutionary model. Creation is not hanging out there just with nothing to go for except you just choose to believe. Actually, it's the very opposite. The facts mount up for creation. And we're going to show you this evening especially that there's absolutely nothing to go along with evolution. And that's quotations by their own scientists. The remedy then for us is to take the time to go through studies like this in the church, to make sure your children understand the facts of life in the sense of what is reality and how we got here. The remedy in the public schools is that creation evolution should be presented thoroughly and fairly in the classrooms. I know they reject the creation because they say it's not science. I would say you could reject the evolutionary model too because it's not science either. Barring that, the facts for the creation model need to be plainly taught in church, the school, the home, defended wherever possible. So these lessons are designed to help you do that. So get a handout and go over it occasionally. So first of all, what is biogenesis? In the field of biology, one of the most commonly accepted and widely used laws of science is the law of biogenics. This law was set forth many years ago to dictate what both theory and experimental evidence showed to be true among living organisms. A quotation here, by the end of the 19th century, there was general agreement that life cannot arise from non-living conditions that now exist upon our planet. There was the thought for a time that maybe, yeah, that was from bad observation, some bad scientific process. Somebody noticed some flies on some meat and thought, oh, well, look at, the meat, the dead material had just, sprung flies. In closer examination, they found out what the flies were doing. They were laying eggs in the meat, and then they were hatching and stuff like that. So there was no such thing as, getting life from non-life. When they started closer experimentation, scientifically approached, they found out that, that wasn't what happening. The dictum, all life from pre-existing life, became the dogma of modern biology, from which no reasonable man could be expected to dissent. This was David Kirk, Biology Today, 1975. Notice what he said. He wrote the textbook and was saying basically, to believe that, something that doesn't go along with biogenesis, no reasonable man would do that. Okay. So the scientists, that want to say, well, we're the reasonable people, the rational ones. Okay. Take it with a grain. Big grain. Okay. Disclaimer, something here. I'm not against all scientists. I love science. Had a lot of it when I was in school. I'm just, against not the scientist, but the science fictionist, who have kind of stolen science and, claimed it for their own. Moore and Slusher, in their textbook, Biology, A Search for Order and Complexity, wrote, historically, the point of view that life comes only from life has been so well established through the facts revealed by experiment that it is called the law of biogenesis. Now, in a footnote, they add, some have called it a principle only, whatever, but, no matter what you call semantics or the way you want to argue it, principle, rule, law, it's all the same. It's what's there and observable against, its opposite. Now, the evidence for biogenesis, we could start by going, okay, this is where, a supporting, what the Bible teaches, like, begins like, everything goes after its kind. Just stop and think of yourself. Did you come from something that wasn't human? How about your parents, your grandparents? I mean, how far back can you take it? Observably, always like begins like, or anything else we've seen. Especially, things that have very short lives, like flies or whatever, they never mutate into something else. We're going to get into mutation in another thing, but just what we can observe, naturally, common sense-wise, like begins like. And in the textbooks, that was one of the primary things you're taught in a biology textbook, is that cell theory, like begins like. Even Darwin, sometimes you ask the scientists, well, Darwin proved it. But notice what Darwin says. In his introduction to Origin of the Species, he wrote, I am well aware that scarcely a single point is discussed in this volume on which facts cannot be adduced, often apparently leading to conclusions directly opposite to those which I have arrived. He's aware that there was dissenting voices, that the stuff he put out there could be argued either way. In fact, he promotes it. A fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question. So even Darwin, said, set them out there and let's look at it, reasonably, rationally, present the facts and see which way they go. Robert Jastrow, in his book, Until the Sun Dies, has written, at present, science has no satisfactory answer to the question of the origin of life on Earth. Let it sink in. At present, science has no satisfactory answer to the question of the origin of life on Earth. Maybe that's why they keep trying to go to Mars or something like that, trying to find it someplace else, because it's not on this planet. Perhaps the appearance of life on the Earth is a miracle. Scientists, though, are reluctant to accept that view, but their choices are limited. I've heard this quote often. I'm going to have to paraphrase it. If you've eliminated all the possibilities, what's left, only even highly improbable, has to be the right answer. Sherlock Holmes. I don't know how much stock you want to put into it. I will tell you that Arthur Conan Doyle was mandatory reading for the Russian army. But Arthur Conan Doyle also had his wife held seances, and he himself believed in fairies. So I don't know how far you want to take this. Perhaps the appearance of life on Earth is a miracle. Scientists are reluctant to accept that view, but their choices are limited. Very limited. Like we said, you either believe in evolution or you believe in creation. I've really not heard an alternative, that's anyway viable. The first theory places the question of origin of life beyond the reach of scientific inquiry. Both are, but you can approach at least the creation another way. It is a statement of faith in the power of a supreme being, not subject to the laws of science, which we covered last week. It has to be a first cause that is not caused itself in the law of causality. And notice, with the lack of evidence for evolution, the science almost have to admit that what we're left with is believing in God, a supreme being. And what you're finding is not the overweight of evidence for evolution, but just the fact they don't want to accept where their conclusions are taking them. They want to discard God out of hand. And so they're latching on the only other possibility they can. And talk about grasping at straws. I mean, in this, you're going to see some admitting, like we did last week, that there's no evidence for what they believe. The act of faith consists in assuming that the scientific view of the origin of life is correct without having concrete evidence to support the belief. This is a scientist talking. This is an evolutionist talking. He also remarked, according to this story, every tree, every blade of grass, every creature in the sea and on earth evolved out of a parent strand of molecular matter drifting lazily in the warm pool. What concrete evidence supports that remarkable theory of the origin of life? There is none. They're fessing up, in their textbooks, in their science articles. Martin A. Moe, writing in Science Digest, expressed it this way: a century of sensational discoveries in the biological science has taught us that life arises only from life, that the nucleus governs the cell through the molecular mechanisms of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, and the amount of DNA and its structure determine not only the nature of the species, but also the characteristics of the individuals. The DNA determines everything. It's all there, designed into it. Okay, you can't jink with the DNA. In their popular text, Life Cloud, notice it's a textbook. Hoyle and, I don't know why they throw the Indian names, Wickramasinghe, prove me wrong in the pronunciation, concluded, it is doubtful that anything like the conditions which were simulated in the laboratory, you're talking about, there was a time when I was younger, when they said, life was discovered in a test tube. Or they've made life in a test tube, or they created life in a test tube, whatever. And that's what they're talking about. These conditions, supposedly. We'll look at the Stanley Miller experiment in one of our upcoming things. But supposedly, that's what they're referring to. That they made these like conditions simulated in a laboratory existed on a primitive Earth, or occurred for long enough times and over sufficiently extended regions of the Earth's surface to produce large enough local concentrations of the biochemicals required to start life. Okay, that's the beginning of the theory. That The gases in the air, the chemicals on the ground were uniting, a little electricity thrown out, and you have the conditions for life. But as they're looking at this, you know, suppose speculation of what it might have been like, in their, starting off with, it is doubtful that anything like the conditions were there. You know, what they're proposing, how life began, those conditions, as they're looking at them, they couldn't find any. In their text, The Mystery of Life's Origin, Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson stated, ideas of chemical evolution have been modified and refined considerably. Many of the findings, however, have not supported the scenario of chemical evolution. Although they kept experimenting, they kept looking, whatever, nothing could support it. In fact, what has emerged over the last three decades, as we have shown in the present critical analysis, is an alternative scenario which is characterized by destruction and not the synthesis of life. That is, the things they say must have existed there in order for life, to begin, they say it was such a destructive environment, it was more for tearing things down than building things up or creating things through a synthesis. They went on to say, even if the primitive atmosphere was reducing or only mildly oxidizing, then degenerative processes predominated over synthesis. The prebiotic chemical soup, presumably a worldwide phenomenon, left no known trace in the geological record. And the sharp edge of this critique, that is, supposedly this stuff would, cover the earth and whatever, and he goes, if you look at for it, you're not going to find it. You can find a record of a flood, a little, something for, the Bible and the Genesis record. But this big prebiotic soup supposedly that existed on the planet, there's no trace of it. And the sharp edge of this critique is not what we do not know, but what we do know. The more we know, the more it vanishes, the possibility that it happened, being there. Okay, in summation, right, evolution, in spite of the facts, that's the scientific mind, unfortunately. I don't want to be sarcastic here, but enough we want to point out that because of an arrogance that exists among a lot of these, you got to stop them and go, look what you're saying. Look at your own comments. Abiogenesis, that is, against biogenesis, or as it is more commonly known, spontaneous generation, that's that getting life from non-life, which was disproved, over a century ago, is one of the foundational concepts of evolution. In 1960, when G.A. Kirkut published his famous book, The Implications of Evolution, I had to send off to England for this thing, but it's worth reading. I've got it in my library. He listed the seven non-probable assumptions upon which evolution is based. Beginning that list was, and basically he said, here's seven categories. And he says, in order for the scientists to believe in evolution, they have to accept all seven of these categories for which there is no evidence whatsoever. They require a greater faith to believe in evolution than your average theological student has to believe in God. But beginning the list was, the first assumption is that non-living things gave rise to living material. Spontaneous generation occurred. So what science has already proven could not occur, the first law that you learn in biology says it doesn't happen that way. Evolution says, no, it did. Nobel laureate George Wald of Harvard said, we have now to face a somewhat different problem. How organisms may have arisen spontaneously under different conditions in some former period, granted that they no longer do. So what do? You put it in. I've seen fiction writers do that. what's his name, Howard, came up with this pre-world, you know, when the continents were all together before they drifted apart. You know, this is where you get your Conan series. You know, occasionally, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, the science fiction writers come up with times before ours, you know, a prehistory, you know, where you can kind of speculate on anything. And that's where they have to go. It is science fiction. And that's what he's saying here. Conditions in some former period, granted that they no longer exist, you can't find them in our lifetime or in our world. So perhaps in some former period, before we have a record of it or whatever, you know, things were different. You know, laws of science were different. To make an organism demands the right substances and the right proportions and the right arrangement. This is one of the major fallacies of science, is that all you have to do is stack up all your molecules or atoms just right, and you get life. Like a shake and bake theory, you know, as long as you keep shaking until everything rearranges and then it comes out. If you want a little humor here, I just read a little thing that said, don't believe an atom because they make up everything. You might take out the word atom and put in scientist, you know, almost in some of this, because they're starting to make up stuff. I mean, seriously, it's getting bad. It's moved out of the realm of science and into speculation of bubble universes and tiny universes and all that kind of stuff. He goes on to say, we do not think that anything more is needed, but that is problem enough. One is only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. You know, you don't get life by just arranging atoms and molecules. Yet, goes on, here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. He just got through saying it doesn't exist. It can't exist. It doesn't do anything. But we're here because of it. Is that really the scientific mind? Is that a rational mind? So I just, you know, now again, all scientists don't think this way. I mean, a lot of, you know, the information we're getting is from scientists that claim the other way. I've got three textbooks right now in my, you know, library written by scientists that are creationists because they feel that the facts are for creation and against evolution. Richard E. Dickerson, writing in Scientific American, so most people know that prestigious publication, remarked that we have no laboratory models, hence one can speculate endlessly, unfettered by inconvenient facts. That's science. We don't have anything to justify anything, therefore we don't have any facts. Therefore, since we don't have facts, we can speculate all we want, you know, as to whatever happened. But let the theologian do that, and they nail him to the wall. They demand evidence for creation. And we've got it. But they don't listen. They don't look. They don't learn. Leslie Orgel, one of the heavyweights in the Origin of Life studies, admitted, we do not yet understand even the general features of the origin of the genetic code. The origin of the genetic code is the most baffling aspect of the problem of the origins of life, and a major conceptual or experimental breakthrough may be needed before we can make any substantial progress. So basically, they're saying the science for evolution is not there. We're hoping for a big breakthrough in this, but it hasn't come yet. Yeah. Darwin waited for a big breakthrough for the change of the things and for his theories to drop in. And he waited for about 10 years, 50 years, whatever, and they never occurred because he was looking down the wrong avenue. J.W.N. Sullivan, a brilliant scientist of the past, penned these words, Careful experiments, nobly those of Pasteur, show that this conclusion was due to imperfect observation and became an accepted doctrine that life never arises except from life. That's biogenesis. That's what the Bible says. That's what good scientists agree with. Okay? Or we should say the scientists of the past. Our problem now is, like someone said, that 90% of all scientists are now still alive. The really good ones from the past, the Newtons, the Einsteins, the Copernicans, the Galileans, you know, whatever, they all believed in God. The things they observed were orderly sequence of things. They didn't hypothesize. They just said, let's just find out what exists and how it's operating, what the mechanics are, what the laws are. And they did it because they believed that God created a cosmos, an orderly universe that could be measured properly. Evolution throws all that out the window. Because basically they're saying all the laws that we have, you know, at some point are violated and bring us all sorts of stuff that we can't prove, we never see, but just got to take it on our word, faith. So far as the actual evidence goes, this is still the only possible conclusion. But since it is a conclusion that seems to lead back to some supernatural creative act, you know, look at what this guy's saying. He's doing exactly what Darwin said. I mean, Darwin kind of sets the scope for all of this. You know, again, we have to paraphrase, but it's in his autobiography. He says, when I stop to think about, you know, using my rational mind, you know, applying my reason and logic, what my mind takes me to is God. He finds God waiting for him at the end of all logical conclusions. So what he had to do was begin to suspect his ability to reason if it grew out of lower animals that did not have that ability. How perfect was your ability to reason if you got it for something that doesn't reason? And a lot of scientists are following the same mode. This guy, it is a conclusion that scientific men find very difficult of acceptance. That is, a supernatural creative force. Although that's where their logic takes them, as they look at all the rules, that's where the rules end up. Let's not go there. Yeah. Let's accept something we have no evidence for whatsoever. The picture's on the handout. It's not that, you know, creation is illogical or irrational. Since we believe that we're created by God, who is a very logical, very rational being, in fact, he often calls men to sit down with him and think things through. In Isaiah, he says, you know, come, let us reason together. You know, let us, you know, look at things. He does that with Job to a good pace. You know, consider the things around. You know, where were you? And he lays a lot of scientific evidence down. You know, where were you? I laid the foundations of the deep, or the foundations of the continents, you know, or the waters of the deep. I mean, there's men like, you know, I guess we'll get to, I'm not sure, sometimes a little ahead of me. But there's people that believed in God. One of the big stories is Matthew Fontaine Murray, that you probably heard of. If you haven't, you've heard of some of his stuff. He was the founder of Annapolis. He was in the Navy. He was an older man when his grandchildren were reading to him. He was on a sickbed, and his grandchildren were reading to him from the Psalms. As they were reading, he goes, wait a minute, read that again. And it talked about, you know, God talking about the streams in the ocean, pathways in the ocean. And so he said, basically, you know, here's a scientist for you. If God says there are paths in the sea, I'm going to go find them. And he did. And wrote the first scientific textbook on the currents of the ocean. The more you put God to the test, the more reasonable he becomes. The more evidence he will produce for you. A lot of it's in the scriptures. You can go and test it out yourself from prophecies, from what Ron talked about this morning, types and antitypes. You know, you're going to find nothing like that in books of men. And men constantly make the mistake of going, oh, the book of the Bible. It's not a book. It's a library written over 1,500 years. Men from different lands, different times, different cultures, all writing about the same God that impressed them in their lifetime with his wonders and his miracles and his workings in this world. When you start accepting the things in the scriptures that have been proven and time-tested by God himself, then the world opens up to you and you begin to see for yourself God all around. He will open your eyes. And truly, the heavens will declare the glory of God. You will be able to see that, yeah, there is a God. And he is working in this world. It is his world. And there's a comfort in that. There's a solace in that in all times. This is what he's trying to give us. A confidence and a faith based on evidence. Not just because we want to believe. You know, he wants himself tested. Because what he speaks is the truth. It's time tested. And it's there to help protect you and to guide you. And this is what we need to share with the world. This call of God to a better life now and an eternal one to come. And again, we caution that word eternal sometimes turns people off, but it's not talking about the longevity of the afterlife. It's talking about the quality of it. Life without measure, beyond your comprehension. Something that you will enjoy every second and praise God for. If you want that sort of thing for yourself and your family and your nation and all the people you love, let us know how we can help to understand how to communicate it. Won't you come as we stand to sing?